From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Recently, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a drug to help women with hypoactive sexual desire disorder, or low libido.
The new drug, bremelanotide, will be available in September. On today's program, we'll learn more from a Mayo Clinic expert.
And over-the-counter treatments for menopause symptoms, do they really work?
Also on the program, treatment for uterine fibroids.
And upper motor neuron syndrome.
That's this week's program.
Well, the FDA has just approved a new drug for women with low sexual desire disorder, low libido. And here to tell us about it and to talk about over-the-counter products that claim they'll help women with the symptoms of menopause is women's health expert, Dr. Stephanie Fabian.
Dr. Fabian is the medical director of the North American Menopause Society and the Bill and Penny George director of Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Fabian.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Impressive credentials. Glad to have you. So let's talk about this new drug.
You were just about to call it female Viagra, weren't
no,
you?
No, I was not. Of course not. Bremelanotide, is that how you pronounce it? And it's the brand name will be Vilesi.
Yes, and it's bremelanotide. That's correct. It's basically one of those brain neurochemicals that affects desire in women and in men. As a matter of fact, but it is one of the excitatory chemicals that in our brains. We also have inhibitory ones. And so whereas the last drug that was introduced to the market affected different chemicals that affect desire, this one is focused on melanocortin in the brain. And it's working on that to presumably increase desire in women.
Do you think it'll work? Does it work? Have the studies that have been done so far show that it's efficacious?
The studies have confirmed that it increases sexual desire and decreases distress associated with low desire in women. Women also were able to fill out a question about whether or not they felt it was beneficial to them, and they did. So yes, it has been determined that it's efficacious. It does have a few side effects. So about 40% of women had difficulty with nausea, and about 20% had difficulty with flushing. And the other thing to note is this requires an injection. So it's given as needed for low desire, not taken every day.
And how long does it last?
It lasts about 45 minutes or so.
Wait.
No, wait. I'm sorry about that. It lasts much longer, a few hours, but you have to use it 45 minutes before you want to have sex.
So you have to get a shot before you're going to have sex, 45 minutes before you would like to have sex.
That is correct.
And you give it to yourself?
Yes.
Really? So you mentioned female Viagra, but it works differently, correct?
It does. It's different brain chemicals that it's working on.
And Viagra works on blood vessels. So it's
Viagra is not a female drug, and it works on blood vessels.
I think that's
leave the guys out.
Well, but we were talking about that you know, to call it female Viagra isn't fair to either drug because they're two completely different things.
Entirely different things. And the two drugs that are on the market, flibanserin and bremelanotide for women, are not affecting blood flow. They are affecting the brain chemicals that affect desire. So it is not a female Viagra, and it's not accurate to call it that.
So what happened to the drug flibanserin? We talked about it a couple of years ago. It came on the market. What happened to it?
It's actually still there, and I believe the company is planning on doing a relaunch. It is difficult for women to get it right now, primarily because it's so expensive.
And wasn't the other problem is that if you were going to take it, it's a daily drug, as you mentioned, but you couldn't drink alcohol. And so some women didn't want to take it because of that.
Well, that is true, although that has changed. The FDA did put out another release in the last month or so that said, indeed, you can drink alcohol. You just can't take the pill within a couple of hours. So that means you have to wait till after 9 o'clock in the morning to take the pill.
Is it true, though, that you had to be an approved or certified healthcare provider in order to write a prescription for that drug?
That Addie? Is true. And that is still the case. So as a provider, I have to be certified, and the pharmacist who is dispensing the drug has to be certified to dispense it.
Let's talk about the new drug, Vileci. Mm-hmm. Who is it for?
So it's for those women with low sexual desire that we can't really identify any other treatable cause for. So that means it's not for the woman who low desire is related to a medication, or it's related to a relationship issue, or it's related to vaginal dryness and pain with sex. That's not going to fix that, right? So this is really, we've gone through the list and we haven't found anything else that would cause that low sexual desire. It's also for women before menopause, not for women after menopause.
Why not after menopause?
It just wasn't approved in that age group yet. And I'm sure it's because the FDA felt like there was not enough study done in postmenopausal women. So unfortunately, that leaves out a big group of women who still have issues.
People who might be interested in that drug.
Right. Yes.
Explain to us a little bit more about how you exclude other causes of low libido before you would prescribe this drug.
So when a woman is in our office and we're really kind of going through this, it takes some time to figure out if there are other causes. So there's the biological causes that could be a medical condition or a medication that they're taking. There's the psychological causes that are things like not feeling great about your body, body image issues, or substance abuse, or a history of abuse, or anxiety or depression. Then there's the sociocultural category, which is sex education, how your family of origin taught, what you heard about sex as a family. And then there's also the relationship category. So how good is the relationship? How good is the communication? Are the logistics even lining up? So after we've gone through all of that, if there really is no obvious cause for low sexual desire, then we say it's probably just a biochemical thing.
You mentioned earlier about the distress that low libido, I think that's the word that you used. There's 8 to 14% of women who do have this problem. Is it really bothersome to a fair percentage of those women?
As you indicate, it does vary between about 8 and 14% of women, but this is really distressing. So it's not just the woman who says, yeah, I have low sexual desire, but it's fine with both my partner and I. This is the woman who says, I feel guilty about it. I'm disappointed. I feel a sense of loss or a sense of grief about lack of desire, and it's ruining my relationship. That is the woman that we really need to focus on.
And you would then teach the woman how to give herself an injection? You
Absolutely.
Do it in the thigh or the arm, or we don't know yet. Somewhere,
I am not that familiar with how this is administered yet because I haven't prescribed it yet. I think it'll be out in the next few months. But yes, I believe it's administered subcutaneously. I'm not sure where.
All right, but you're optimistic about how effective it will be?
You know, I think it will be an answer for some women, not for all. And again, the more choices that we have for women to deal with distressing sexual problems, the better. And the more attention we bring to this, I think that having a conversation is a good thing. So the fact that this drug is allowing more of a conversation about women's sexual health is always healthy.
All right, we're talking with women's health expert, Dr. Stephanie Fabian. There's a new drug for women with low sexual desire disorder, recently approved by the FDA. It's called bremelanotide.
Bremelanotide.
Bremelanotide, also Vileci, right?
Yes.
That's the brand name.
And I found it. It's administered in the thigh or the abdomen 45 minutes before sex.
All right. It should be available in September. Let's turn the tables and talk about postmenopausal women, because there are a lot of women who experience symptoms when they reach menopause, and there are a lot of over-the-counter options out there that claim that they will reduce the symptoms, whether it's hot flashes or night sweats or depression or sleep disorder, etc. Are there some over-the-counter options, some over-the-counter products that do in fact work?
The broad answer would be not really, unfortunately. So there are many things out there that are marketed for hot flashes and night sweats in postmenopausal women, but we don't have a lot that are really proven to be effective in scientific studies. The one exception might be a derivative of isoflavones or soy, and that is called S-Equal. There are some promising studies in that, but I would say it's even really too early to be wholesale marketing that one for hot flashes and night sweats. So no the landscape on the herbal supplements and vitamins and that sort of thing is kind of underwhelming at this point.
Now, what about, there are some celebrities, in fact, who are touting bioidentical hormones for menopausal symptoms?
Boy, that is a sticky question. So the first part of that is, what does bioidentical mean? Bioidentical just means it's chemically, structurally the same as what your body used to make. And when we're talking about estrogen, that is estradiol. And when we're talking about the progestin or progestogen part of it, it means it's real progesterone. So bioidentical can be compounded, which is what we're talking about here. These pharmacies and some of these celebrities are touting. And what they're touting is that these products can be customized just for you. And there's a bit of a myth there. So these products are also available in FDA-approved products in your local pharmacy, and the FDA regulates them, so we know that what is in the bottle is actually what's on the label. But the other thing about this is we don't really know what level or dose of hormones is going to work for any one woman. And so saying that everybody has to have the same blood level or saliva level is inaccurate, because we just don't have evidence to say that that's where your symptoms are going to go away. So there's also concerns about purity and potency. So batch-to-batch variability. So 1 month you might get something in the bottle that's got one strength, and the next month it might be different. Mm-hmm. And they've actually done studies to measure this, and the amounts in the bottle are all over the place.
Ooh, so that doesn't sound. So don't waste your money on over-the-counter remedies. And there's a lot of question about the bioidentical hormones.
Well, the custom compounded variety. We do have FDA-approved bioidentical hormones, and those are the ones that we typically prescribe.
So hormone therapy for postmenopausal symptoms.
Correct.
But isn't that still controversial?
No, it's not controversial anymore. The hormones are safe and effective, and they are the most effective treatment for women who are having symptoms, who are younger women who are in their 50s within 10 years of their last menstrual period and having bothersome hot flashes and night sweats. This is not controversial anymore. And for the large majority of these women who are healthy, they are good candidates to use this, and it will reduce their symptoms by about 90 to 95%.
I think when it comes to over-the-counter, the medication that I hear most often from women in my age group is Ambaren. What do you know about that over-the-counter medication?
You know, before we had this discussion, I knew nothing about that medication, but actually...
Thank goodness we told you we were going to ask.
Right.
Because it's advertised. We listen to AM radio.
You are much more informed than I am.
But it's advertised on there all the time.
Isn't that fascinating? Because looking at the ingredients, there's nothing in there that would really help with hot flashes. So it's kind of shocking that we can have false advertising like this in the United States. And there's really is no evidence that the ingredients on that bottle would help you with hot flashes.
Let's go back to the hormones, because I thought the Women's Health Initiative study that came out a decade or so put the kibosh on prescribing hormone therapy for postmenopausal women. Because of the potential side effects.
We have come full circle, and we are back around to the beginning. And when they finally, in the Women's Health Initiative, which came out in 2002, I know time flies, but when we came back around and finally looked at the women in their 50s specifically, it turns out that everybody agrees the benefits outweigh the risk for healthy women who are having symptoms. So it probably has a beneficial effect on the heart. It definitely helps bones. It helps your hot flashes and night sweats. It's probably neutral, possibly helpful with regard to dementia risk. The main concern remains the breast cancer risk. And for women without a uterus who have had a hysterectomy, there is no increased risk of breast cancer. It's the women who have a uterus and have to take the progestogen with the estrogen to protect that uterine lining that there's a slight increased risk of breast cancer. And when we say slight, We're talking 8 to 9 extra cases per 10,000 women per year after about 5 years of treatment. And that's about the same as between 1 and 2 glasses of wine a night. It's about the same as being obese, and it's about the same as being inactive.
And you call it hormone therapy now. You don't call it hormone replacement therapy, because you're not trying to replace what the hormones that they used to have.
You're exactly right. We are just trying to control symptoms. We are not trying to make you 25 again. So we are not trying to give you everything that ovary used to make back. We're just trying to manage symptoms.
You are the medical director of the North American Menopause Society. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What does that mean to you? What do you hope to accomplish in this role?
Well, it's a new role for me. I just took this on last week, as a matter of fact. And I think, you know, it is the premier medical society in North America for midlife women's health. And I think if we can figure out better ways to treat women in midlife and prevent the consequences of aging and help women live healthier lives, that would be the goal. We have a great membership, and I think in the future we hope to bring more education to providers, but also to patients and women out there in North America.
What about the idea that you have to battle through menopause instead of, and now that I'm gone through it, I just think there's so much in the way that we talk about it, instead of it's a part of life that you experience, instead of the detrimental side of what it does to you. I mean, there's a lot of bad things that you don't enjoy as you're going through menopause. But right. I've really noticed the way that you think about it and talk about it makes a huge difference.
You're exactly right about that. And I don't think we have enough conversations, and it shouldn't be seen as a disease process. It really is a phase of life. But there are a lot of potential health consequences that come along with going through menopause. For instance, our heart disease risk goes up to that of men after we go through menopause. And so it's a time where women really should feel that they can take their health into their own hands and be proactive about healthy aging. So I think you're right. We need to shift the conversation a little bit to how do we age in a healthy way, rather than menopause being the beginning of the end.
We need an update before we finish on the HPV vaccine, because there have been some new recommendations, right? First of all, tell us what the vaccine is for and the new recommendations.
So the vaccine is for human papillomavirus, which is the virus that can cause cervical cancer in women, but also penile cancer in men. So it doesn't just affect women. But the vaccine change, the CDC has now recommended that it used to be recommended up until the age of 26. In both boys and girls. And now what it's done is extend that to the age of 45, so that individuals who haven't been fully immunized up until that age can talk about it with their medical providers and consider getting the update to get the vaccines and get covered through that. So there really is little to lose. This is a cancer-preventing vaccine, and it's the first one that we've ever had. So really there is little downside, except it may take insurance coverage a little time to catch up with this new recommendation.
And not to forget that it also can cause throat cancer in both men and women.
Throat cancer is really increasing too, so good point.
Dr. Stephanie Fabian, Medical Director of the North American Menopause Society and Director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health. And by the way, Dr. Fabian's book is called The Menopause Solution, A Doctor's Guide to Relieving Hot Flashes, Enjoying Better Sex, Sleeping Well, Controlling Your Weight, and Being Happy. I mean, how can you not buy that one?
You gotta love him.
Available on Amazon. Dr. Fabian is optimistic about the new drug for premenopausal women with low libido, and that should be available in September. For postmenopausal women, it's important to now know, and we know from one of the world's experts, that most over-the-counter remedies for the symptoms of menopause are not worth the money. But there are effective, legitimate options. And finally, the new HPV vaccine is approved for men and women up to the age of 45. Dr. Stephanie Fabian, thanks for all the valuable information.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, treatment for uterine fibroids.
And surgical treatment for upper motor neuron syndrome.
Coming up, a Health Minute with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. You might not think of bones as being alive, but they are. Every day, your body breaks down old bone and replaces it with new bone. As you get older, however, the ratio becomes unequal. More bone is lost than gained. If too much is lost, then you can develop the bone disease osteoporosis. Now, osteoporosis can cause bones to become weak, brittle, and prone to break. Osteoporosis-related fractures most commonly occur in the spine, wrist, and hip. In addition to bone fractures, osteoporosis can cause bone pain, loss of height, and a stooped posture. All of these symptoms can lead to feelings of anxiety and depression. No one can say for sure which individuals will develop osteoporosis, but research has revealed what makes some people more likely than others to develop it. That's why it's important to be aware of the risk factors and what you can do about them. So these are some common risk factors for osteoporosis. Age, gender, both genders can get it, but osteoporosis is most common among postmenopausal women. Ethnicity, Caucasians and Asians are at greater risk of osteoporosis. Hispanics and Native Americans appear to have an intermediate risk, while African Americans have the lowest risk. Genetics. Family history is a predictor of low bone mass, but it doesn't mean you'll get it. Body frame size. Men and women with small body frames tend to have a higher risk because they usually have less bone mass to draw from as they age. And certain health conditions and medications can also increase your risk. So what can you do? Well, it's never too late to do something about your bone health. So here's some risk factors that you can change. Although the risks may seem daunting, it's important to realize that there are some factors for osteoporosis that you can control. And again, it's never too late to do something about it. First, get enough calcium and vitamin D. Eat a healthy diet, as severely restricting food intake and being underweight can weaken bone. Get regular physical activity. Don't smoke and limit alcohol use. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Uterine fibroids, or fibrous tumors of the uterus, they're more common than you might think. In fact, doctors perform more than 200,000 hysterectomies, that's removal of the uterus, every year to get rid of uterine fibroids. Not for cancer or anything else, but for uterine fibroids.
Good news, though, there are now other options. And here to talk to us about uterine fibroids and the newer alternatives available for treatment is vascular and interventional radiologist Dr. Erica Navel-Kepsel. Very nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you as well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks. You know, we don't have radiologists very often, but we particularly don't have interventional radiologists. What's the difference between an interventional radiologist and a regular radiologist?
Right. So a diagnostic radiologist will specialize mostly in interpretation of different imaging modalities, such as CT scans, MRIs, ultrasound, and other various modalities. Some diagnostic radiologists also do procedures. The difference is in vascular and interventional radiology, we primarily only do procedures. So we actually do procedures inside the blood vessels, inside the arteries and the veins. We do interventions into the chest and organs in the abdomen. So we treat a whole variety of diseases.
What's the most common thing you do as an interventional radiologist? I guess it would vary, but what do you do?
What do I do? So it can vary from day to day, and that's some of the enjoyment of the practice. One of the things that we do quite often is central venous access, so putting in lines for chemotherapy and nutrition and durable venous access. Some of the things that I specialize in personally are venous disease. So if there are veins that are narrowed, I help go in, open those veins back up, and place stents in order to restore flow. I also specialize in complex IVC filter removal, so filters that have been in for many years, even decades, we can go in and take those out. And the other thing that I specialize in is uterine artery embolization. That's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. So first of all, it seems like everyone I know at some point has to have a conversation of they either have a fibroid or they might have a fibroid. Mm-hmm. So it must be pretty common.
They are definitely very common. And a lot of times, many women have them and don't even know because they can be completely asymptomatic or without symptoms. When they start to cause issues, is when women present to their gynecologist usually for further workup.
And when they are symptomatic, what does a woman feel? What does she notice?
So there are a variety of symptoms. Some are related to heavy menstrual bleeding because of where the fibroid is located within the uterus. There are also symptoms related to kind of bulk of the fibroid. If you get really large fibroids, they can cause some pelvic pain, pelvic pressure. It can also cause you to have frequent urination, and also many women can even suffer from constipation. So kind of a wide variety of symptoms.
So tricky, because it's one of those things, you know, you're like middle-aged and then, it's the beginning of menopause, or, oh no, I've gained too much weight, mm-hmm. or there's so many, again, things that can play into that. It takes a long time to figure out.
Right, and that's true. The women who most commonly have fibroids and are symptomatic from fibroids are usually in the childbearing years. Mm-hmm. The fibroids are stimulated by estrogen and progesterone hormones that are in abundance when you're in your childbearing years. And actually, after menopause, the fibroids can decrease in size and become less symptomatic as that estrogen and progesterone levels decrease.
Yeah, pretty interesting. So you heavy menstrual periods is one of that's the mm-hmm. probably the key symptom. Yeah. And then you mentioned constipation and some of these other symptoms, which suggest to me that these things must get pretty big sometimes.
They can be. They can be up to, you know, we've seen them 14, 15 centimeters in size, even larger.
So that's
larger.
Like 5 or 7 inches or so.
Right.
So really?
So they can be quite big. And when they're that big, you think of how much space is in the pelvis. They tend to put pressure on either the bladder, which causes you to have frequent urination, or they can put pressure on the bowel and the rectum, which makes it more difficult to go to the bathroom.
So previously, that would be removed, the fibroid would be removed, maybe also the uterus removed at the same time. And how can you help? Because having your uterus removed is kind of a big deal.
It definitely is a big deal, and I'm glad we have a variety of treatment options available to us today. The one that I specialize, uterine artery embolization, this is a procedure that we have been doing for many years and have had some really excellent results with. What we do is we enter into the arterial system, or into one of the arteries, either through a small artery in the wrist or the artery in the groin. Then we feed our catheters and wires into the two arteries that are feeding the uterus.
All right. Now, you're watching this on a fluoroscope, right? So
exactly.
You can see where this catheter is going,
right.
So it doesn't wander someplace you don't want.
Exactly.
And you can guide it.
Yes.
All right.
So we use real-time x-rays to help guide our wires and catheters into place. Once we are in the uterine artery, we inject contrast to make sure that we're where we think we are. And we usually see filling of the fibroid with the contrast material that we inject.
So you're finding the artery that actually feeds the fibroid?
It feeds the fibroid and the uterus.
Okay. But aren't you worried about cutting off the blood supply to more than just the fibroid?
That's a reasonable concern. Yeah, that's the tricky part. You have to kind of know when to back off on your embolization or when you should proceed. But preferentially, a lot of the blood flow goes to the fibroids. So as a result of that, a lot of the embolic material or the little particles that we inject.
Yeah, we got to stop embolic. So tell us what you're doing, what you mean by that.
So when we say embolization, it basically means to shut off or occlude or block an artery.
You're plugging the artery.
Plugging the artery,
okay.
Exactly. So a lot of the blood flow preferentially will go to the fibroids. So when you're injecting your material that you're going to use for the embolization, it will preferentially go to the fibroids first.
And what material do you use to plug it?
They're small little permanent spheres. They're very tiny on the micron level of size, and they go into the arteries feeding the fibroid and just plug up those arteries feeding the fibroid. And then we keep the main uterine artery patent or open so the rest of the uterus can get blood supply.
How long does it take after you've injected this material for I assume that the fibroid will then shrink. How long does that take?
It can take up to a couple of months for it to shrink. So it's a slower process, but women usually can have some initial relief about 3 months after the procedure.
Do you sometimes have to do this more than once?
Occasionally we do. Sometimes the fibroids are supplied by accessory arteries or additional arteries besides the uterine artery. So if that happens, we can go back in and make sure we embolize those arteries as well. It's a little bit less common. And then sometimes if the fibroid's so big, sometimes we can get some initial shrinkage. But
is it a pretty successful procedure?
It is a successful procedure. Rates in the literature for shrinkage of fibroids are between 40 and 75%. So there's a little bit of variation, but I think sometimes women just need a little bit of the shrinkage to mm-hmm. get the symptoms under control.
Are there any other modalities short of a hysterectomy that might be as good or that women should consider?
Alternative to embolization, there are many. You know, we usually start with more conservative measures first. So that would be like medications to help regulate some of the hormones. The only unfortunate part about that is once you stop taking the medications, then the fibroids can regrow again, become more symptomatic. Women can have IUDs to help control their heavy menstrual bleeding, which is important. We also have some other techniques, surgical and non-surgical, that we can perform. So one of them is MR-guided focus ultrasound. In this procedure, we use the MR scanner to locate the fibroids. Once the fibroids are located, we can focus a beam of sonic wave or ultrasound energy into the fibroid, which basically heats it and destroys the fibroid that way. So that's an excellent procedure as well. And then there's some of the other surgical procedures, going through the abdomen to remove the fibroids, going through the vagina into the uterus to remove fibroids. So there are a lot of different options. And it's best to have a well-rounded discussion with your gynecologist and interventional radiologist to discuss.
Well, uterine fibroids, they're certainly common, and it's good to know that there are a lot of different options for treatment. Traditionally, it's been hysterectomy, but now a lot of other options for women who have this problem. Interventional radiologist Dr. Naval Kapsel, thanks so much for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Tracy, there are thousands of people in this country who are disabled because of injuries to their spinal cord or their brain. It's the result of trauma, stroke, cerebral palsy at birth, or even an infection. But what's not widely known is that there are surgical procedures that can often help these patients to improve their quality of life and also their function.
I had no idea. We're going to find
out.
I'm
glad you're here.
That's right. Joining us in studio is Mayo Clinic orthopedic hand surgeon Dr. Peter Ree and one of his patients, Brett Zube, and Brett's father, John Zube. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Welcome, Dr. Ree. Nice to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
Also, Mr. Zube, Brett Zube, thanks so much for being with us. So let's start with you, Dr. Ree. Tell us about your work and how you got involved in with patients like this.
Well, we have a multidisciplinary practice here where we evaluate and treat patients that have had a brain injury or a spinal cord injury. And it really stemmed from my experience when I was a hand surgeon in the Air Force, taking care of young patients with brain injuries. And admittedly, I really didn't take care of patients at the time with stroke, cerebral palsy, or spinal cord injuries. And it wasn't until actually my dad had multiple strokes and he ended up with hemiplegia. His arm got
meaning contracted. Partial paralysis of half of his body.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And then contractures that developed. And then, unfortunately, my oldest nephew became a spinal cord injury patient, too. And a lot of things that even as a Mayo-trained hand surgeon, I didn't realize there were things that we could do until I had a personal vested interest in it. And I thought, boy, there's a lot of things, but why aren't we doing it? So that's where we started.
And when you say contractures, you mean that the joints become stiff and you can't move them?
Yes, sir.
That's part of the problem?
Yes, and that's typically drawn out by the fact that when you have an injury to the brain or the spinal cord, there is a reflex mechanism in your muscle and it becomes unchecked. And the muscles get a little tight, they are overly active, and then it draws the deformity in the arms or the legs. And after a long period of time, the joints can get stuck in that position.
So you said to yourself, there must be a way I can help these patients?
Yes, sir.
And that you figured out operations that could improve their function?
Yes, sir. And those procedures have been around. It's just not done with much frequency. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that information is pretty old. And so now we're coming up with new innovative techniques to help advance the rehab for patients.
All right, so Mr. Zube, let me ask you, you're Brett's father.
Yes.
And when did you first know that Brett had a problem?
Well, before he was a year old, he wasn't developing quite the way we thought. And we thought, you know, maybe he's still a little slow or something, but we eventually went to a doctor and they gave us the diagnosis that he had cerebral palsy. And
it wasn't until a year old that you knew that.
Yeah. And we had no idea what this was going to be in our lives, what it means, you know. And it's a huge challenge. So,
and what did you find most difficult in trying to care for Brett during those when he was younger?
Well, when he was younger, it wasn't so bad. The spasticity in his arms and legs gets worse with time. So the longer, the older he got, the more stiff he became and the less things he could do. I mean, when he was real little, he could pick up a fork and spoon and feed himself, and then that went away, and he was never able to walk. In the beginning, he was kind of working on that, but that ended up being, so you just keep finding out more and more things that he couldn't do, I guess.
What became the biggest challenge then in caring for him? Because not only, I mean, he's growing up during that time too.
Right, yeah. When he was younger, it wasn't so bad. Once he became more of an adult, that's when dressing him became hard. His arms were up here, his hands were clenched. It was hard to cut his fingernails. It was hard to get him dressed. You couldn't get shirts over his arms. That was very difficult. Going to doctors, they couldn't get an armband around to check his blood pressure. Taking blood was difficult. Cutting his fingernails was hard because his fingers were just a
lot. So he had severe contractures, basically, of his arms, his elbows, his wrists, his fingers.
Everything, yeah.
Got worse as he got older.
Right. Yep.
Were you aware at all that there might be some surgical procedures that would help him? And how did you end up with Dr. Reeve?
No, I mean, we've been doing procedures. Brett's had so many operations over the years on different things. One of the things we were trying to relax him was Botox injections in his arms, which is this big needle that goes in, you know, and supposed to loosen things up. We tried that several times, wasn't working, and that doctor suggested Peter Reeve for us.
I just want to know, Brett, is it painful when his arms are pulled up like that? Is that painful for you?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're up like this all the time, he's in pain a lot.
So how can you help him, Dr. Reeve? What did you do?
Well, we always try to start with non-surgical methods, and Botox is one. There's medications, even baclofen pumps, which is a medicine to decrease the spasticity. But when it gets this severe, like Brett's left arm, it's really tough for splints to work. It's just, like you said, it gets to a point that it's so severe, it's hard to do all your basic needs. And so pretty much the philosophy is this. If there's any control in the arm, that Brett can actually do anything with the muscles, we try not to take that away. We just try to get the joints positioned in a better way. So whatever function he has, we can just enhance it. Or if there's no function whatsoever, then it's just to get the arm and the elbow and the hands out in a better position for hygiene purposes. And our motto in our clinic is if we can just position Brett's arm better, then other people can take better care of Brett. And so the techniques are pretty unique. It's either lengthening muscles, releasing the joints, manipulating the nerves, but the basic principles are not to take anything away, but to help with just quality of life.
So what did you do to his arm?
Actually, Brett, buddy,
in 90 seconds or less.
Okay. Yes. In 90 seconds or less, we fixed the contracture, which I think visually you can see the left arm and the right arm were almost identical. And so now Brett involving multiple plastic surgery type stuff in the elbow, preserving the function. Brett, can you bend your elbow up and down? So trying not to take anything away, but then getting his fingers out of his palm, the wrist straight. It's a lot of work. Brett and I spent a lot of time together. Yeah. Most of the time you were asleep though.
Yeah. How long was the surgery?
Well, this surgery took us close to about, I think 6 hours or so. Traditionally, what's done in multiple stages around the world, we do it all very safely in a single surgery.
Wow, pretty incredible. So when you learned about this and talked with Dr. Reeve, were you gung-ho, or were there some concerns on your part, Mr. Zube?
Well, it's not me that has to be gung-ho. It has to be Brett.
Yeah.
I mean, Brett has to be the one that decides if he wants the surgery or not. And long story short, he's had 18 to 20 surgeries. Some have been really good, some have not gone well. A lot of his recent ones, the doctors say, we'll do this, and he comes out worse. Mm. So he was not up for this. He didn't even want to see Dr. Reeve. So we finally had to, we just kept saying, he's not going to make you do anything. You know, just if listen. You want to, just go in and listen to him. when he did listen to him, Peter just won him over with his personality. Brett wasn't immediately saying, yes, I want to do it, but he made it seem so confident in what he was going to do that Brett eventually agreed to it.
And folks can see, if they're watching our YouTube video, they can see the difference in Brett's arms. If you're just listening on the radio, I will tell you, Brett's right arm looks relaxed, and your left arm still does look like it is painful. Brett, are you going to do your left arm?
We've been talking with orthopedic upper extremity surgeon Dr. Peter Ree and his patient Brett, and Brett's father, Mr. John Zube. I guess for patients who become disabled from brain or spinal cord injuries, there are surgical procedures that can improve function and quality of life, and I think you've proven that, Dr. Ree. It sounds like those surgeries maybe should be done more often and more people in the hands of an expert like you.
Yes, sir. I think that people that dabble in it, there's a lot of things that you make one change as a downstream effect, and if you, unless you've had the experience, you can definitely hurt people, like John said. And so I think it's good to come to a place that has a great team with multiple different providers.
Yep. And first, do no harm.
Yes, sir.
Brett Zube, Mr. John Zube, and Dr. Peter Ree, thanks so much for being with us. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Brett.
And that's our program this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.